Blackwater.
The people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago.
Do you feel burned by the people who hired you to work?
To a certain extent, yes.
So there are regrets?
Oh, yeah, seriously, regret.
Russia is killing ISIS, and Iran is killing ISIS.
Private armies have become multinational organizations and expanded their activities thanks to warmongering of the Western governments. Imagine an oil company trying to explore and extract petroleum in a war-torn country. Obviously, the army cannot use its forces to protect employees and engineers, as well as oil processing facilities. So the company has to use a private army. Accordingly, a number of American and British military veterans have been setting up their own private armies for years and are now serving their customers as well as governments.
During the operation in Bab al-Amr, the Syrian army arrested fighters from Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and some European states. Their work was coordinated by Qatari and Saudi intelligence officers, as well as CIA, Mossad, and Blackwater agents. It's also seized Israeli weapons, especially anti-tank missiles and Israeli drones.
Blackwater is a mercenary force that was hired originally by the Bush administration to go into Afghanistan first in 2002 on covert CIA contracts.
But they existed before that.
They existed before that as a training company.
A private security company. Well, don't they guard our high-level, high-security people?
Right. The Obama administration continues to contract with Blackwater. The fact is that what we saw after 9/11 was this mercenary force run by Eric Prince, an avowed Christian supremacist, essentially embed itself in the U.S. national security apparatus. And beginning in 2002, was providing private soldiers for hire to the government, initially on covert CIA contracts. But now, for instance, Blackwater has a $100+ million contract in Afghanistan. They guard top U.S. officials there. They're still in Iraq, armed right now.
At an earlier time, Blackwater was usually heard in the news. The mercenaries of this security company opened fire on Iraqi people several times and assassinated many civilians. Although in those days, more than a decade ago, it was not possible to make extensive use of social media like today, the media reached videos of Blackwater's activities during the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. Of course, you may know by a handful the whole sack. Now, you often hear Academy as the largest private security company in the Middle East and, obviously, in Iraq. Several other companies came to Iraq during the years of occupation, some of which, such as G4S, still have large contracts with the Iraqi government. If you go to Baghdad International Airport, you see G4S security guards there. These companies still protect many hotspots, such as oil processing facilities and foreign embassies.
Harper's Magazine writer Charles Glass has gotten his hands on some videos from private contractors in Iraq. These are Blackwater guys. He's calling them the warrior class, and they're doing a feature on it. I can't wait for it. And what they've done is found out, of course, how these guys operate in Iraq. Now, some of us have heard these stories before, but now you get to see video attached to it. Yeah, they're looking at you rolling through their town like a madman. Now, here's the thing. They put it to rock music, and some people might look at that and go, ah, cool, yeah, they get to run over the other cars, yeah. But you have to understand something. These are real people, okay? Now, when you smash into their cars, maybe it's no big deal to you, but that's probably one of the most important things they own, and let alone the fact that if it's true that they're firing the weapons, God knows where those bullets land. But the overall idea is, God, they have such an enormous disregard for the civilians that we were there to, quote-unquote, liberate. And the whole idea is, we're the big bad Americans, the laws don't apply to us, get out of our way. And then, gee, I wonder why the Iraqis hated us. You're not convinced yet? Wait till you see the second video. Right in the beginning, one of these guys is going to run over a civilian, and then everybody's just going to roll on by like nothing happened. And they just keep on rolling. Gee, I wonder why the Iraqis didn't like us. I can't quite figure it out. Maybe it was our enormous disregard for their lives. Like we didn't give a damn. As we pretended that we were there to give them freedom and democracy.
So we've spent all this money to train them. They leave, they go work for Eric Prince's Christian supremacist fighting force to eliminate Muslims and destroy Islam globally, and then they bill taxpayers again for this killing that they're doing, and they're not held to the same standard as soldiers. The Bush administration made sure that they were immune from any prosecution. They were an armed wing of the administration, and unfortunately it continues under Obama.
There became such a cyclone of nonsense that would feed off itself, and it built us into a 10-foot-tall boogeyman, which just wasn't the case.
And you were ready to return fire?
I was ready to set the record straight.
Utilization of Blackwater facilitated the arrival of mercenaries and professional soldiers from around the world to fight as the company's personnel in Iraq. They had contracts to protect American figures such as Paul Bremer and other U.S. officials living in Iraq, and of course, the companies were responsible for protecting American facilities and CIA detention centers. Their presence in the war is still evident even after years since the withdrawal of American troops.
Please go to the next picture. Next. There's an instance of detainees and how they were treated in a nice manner. Next. Video that I'm going to show you is a tank round that went into that minaret.
Did your people ever kill innocent civilians?
It's entirely possible.
My name is John Michael Turner. I currently reside in Burlington, Vermont. I served with Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines as an automatic machine gunner. There's a term, once a Marine, always a Marine, but there's also the term, eat the apple, F the Corps. I don't work for you no more.
Afternoon of September 16th, 2007, in Baghdad, in an area called the Mansour District. But on this particular day, a 20-year-old Iraqi medical student named Ahmed Haitham al-Rubai was driving in a car with his mother, Mahassin, the family's white Opel sedan. His mother also was a doctor, and they had just dropped off his father, Dr. Jawad. He also was a doctor. Medicine was very much in this family's. This is common in Iraq. When the most important people in Iraq come careening down the road, the Iraqi police have to stop traffic. And of course, the most important people in Iraq are not Iraqis. They are U.S. VIPs. And so on this day, when these armored vehicles were coming into the square and Ahmed and his mother were pulling into the square, the men inside of the armored vehicles decided that they viewed Ahmed Haitham al-Rubai and his mother Mahassin as potential terrorists or car bombers, and they decided to shoot Ahmed Haitham al-Rubai in his head. Gunfire rained down on that vehicle, and witnesses say that the car exploded and burst into flames, burning Mahassin and her son Ahmed inside of the vehicle. That kicked off 15 minutes of a very heavy gunfire at Nisr Square that day, and it lasted about, as I say, a quarter of an hour. Children were killed that day, women were killed that day. In fact, several people who survived, and also some who were killed, were shot in the back as they tried to flee the scene. And the individuals who did the shooting that day from those armored vehicles, they were private forces working for Blackwater.
Blackwater is a company that we contracted out to in Iraq and Afghanistan, many parts of the world. And they caused us a tremendous amount of trouble. You remember the 17 civilians that they killed in Nisr Square in Baghdad? That became a huge scandal and an investigation. But that was one of many, many things that they had done wrong, including, by the way, bilking the U.S. government. They killed so many innocent civilians in so many different areas with such little regard for civilian life, actually knew about Blackwater and what Blackwater did back in Iraq. Now, this is amazing. So State Department puts Gene Richter on the case and says, hey, look, we got all these reports about Blackwater ripping us off, unsafe conditions, let alone what they're doing to the Iraqis. But we're worried about what they're doing to us, to our troops, to our reputation, to our relationship with Iraq, and our money.
And that was part of the thing, going to Iraq. He was told he would protect Paul Bremer. He was going to be private security for Paul Bremer, the ambassador. He had just arrived in Baghdad. He had only been there 2 days. And that night, they told Scotty that if he did not go on this security mission to escort this convoy that was going to the 182nd Airborne to pick up kitchen equipment, that he would be on the streets of Baghdad that night. He would pay back whatever monies he had received from Blackwater, and he would be on his own to get home. Those vehicles had the GPS on it, but unfortunately, they were set for the United States. So the GPS didn't help him a whole lot in Iraq. So Scott says, give us a map, do something. They kind of did their foot.
No map.
He says, we have no idea where we're going. None of those men had ever been to Fallujah. Instead of going around Fallujah, as they should have, they went right through the middle of it.
And why are you against them? Why? Okay.
Because they don't care about the men they hire. The only thing they care about is the money. They're prostitutes. I refer to them as the whores of war.
You talk about President Obama in the book, and you say your connection to President Obama is, quote, closer than he has ever wanted to admit. What do you mean?
Just that there is some of these key programs that he was depending on.
That he knew you were involved with?
Probably so, yeah.
Have you met him?
Never.
You write, I am no hero. The world knows all too well about my mistakes, but I was never meant to play the villain. Do you feel burned by the people who hired you to work?
To a certain extent, yes.
So there are regrets?
Oh, yeah. Seriously, regrets.
Wouldn't do it again?
I'm not so sure that I would.
You signed the contract. Is that the way it should have been done?
After the endless lawsuits, fines, professionally and financially, it's like 13 lost years.
It's just political, you think, at this point? Was Blackwater involved in the drone program?
It's been publicly reported many times that the company was.
And you would not dispute that?
Well, the media reports a lot of it, and I won't dispute that one, no.
What can you tell us about your relationship with the CIA?
There was all kinds of things the company did, and there was things that I did personally.
Miss one guy, people would get thrown off a bridge and then people would forget about him. So he's like in the middle of this combat zone when it's an absolute disaster in Iraq in 2007. If this guy kills him right there. But New York Times explains, American embassy officials in Baghdad sided with Blackwater
The study of history shows us that terrorists or subversive groups no longer exist as soon as they lose the support of a country, a business company, or a rich person. Those who always remain in the service of their patrons may be out of sight for a while, like Al-Qaeda, but will reappear one day. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces have recently raided several homes near the occupied West Bank city of Ariha and brutally assaulted a 17-year-old Palestinian girl. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Israeli regime forces have recently brutally assaulted a Palestinian girl after raiding several homes in the Arab Melihat community northwest of the occupied West Bank city of Ariha. Hassan Melihat, the general supervisor of Al-Baidar Organization for the Defense of Bedouin Rights, told Wafa News Agency that Israeli troops attacked a 17-year-old Palestinian girl after raiding her family house in the said community. The Zionist regime's violence against Palestinian women is routine in the occupied West Bank. An investigation conducted by Israeli rights group B'Tselem revealed that last July, scores of Israeli troops and army dogs broke into the home of the Palestinian Ajluni family in Al-Khalil, separated the men from the women and children, and forced the women to undress. Meanwhile, the Prisoners and Ex-Prisoners Affairs Commission said in a report, Palestinian prisoner Fatemeh Amrane, 41, from the northern West Bank city of Jenin, was subjected to the worst kinds of abuse and torture when she was arrested by Zionist regime forces in occupied Al-Quds. Amrane was arrested on September 4th in occupied East Al-Quds as she was coming out from Al-Aqsa Mosque. She told the commission's attorney, Hassan Khatib, that an Israeli troop kicked her, claiming she tried to stab him. Then other troops attacked her and severely beat her until she lost consciousness. When she woke up, she found herself shackled inside a police jeep. Amrane was then transferred to the Jaffa Gate police station, Al-Qishli, where she was interrogated, tortured and beaten. Amrane reportedly told the lawyer, "They put me in the prisoner's transport bus and they stepped hard on me." Adding, "Sometimes the bus would go fast and then stop suddenly. They transferred me from one place to another to put pressure on me and to infuriate me. Police women tightened my handcuffs to hurt me while they pushed me, kicked me, and beat me." According to the reports, Amrane was also terrorized and violated while Israeli police women strip-searched many times. She told her lawyer, "They ripped my outer garment and then they transferred me to Ramle prison where I slept without eating anything. Then they put me in solitary confinement in a dreary and coarse cell with a bed and thin leather mattress, no pillows, and a dirty and stinky blanket." Amrane's attorney said that the bruises on the prisoner's body were still visible and that parts of her clothes had blood stains on them. According to Tasnim News Agency, the United Nations has called for an investigation into the forced stripping of five Palestinian women by the Zionist regime forces in the West Bank's Al-Khalil. The regime forces entered the Ajlouni's family house on the morning of July 10th. Two female troops took the 53-year-old mother, her 17-year-old daughter, and the mother's three daughters-in-law, all in their 20s, into the children's room where they were compelled to undress. Armed with rifles with an attack dog, the occupation troops also threatened to unleash the dog if the Palestinian women did not comply with the order to strip nude, even as they conducted body searches of the clawed men. Farhan Haq, the deputy spokesperson for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, responded to a question about the assault, stating, "We would stand against any form of collective punishment." He added, "Obviously, this reported incident needs to be looked at and investigated thoroughly." Additionally, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese, expressed her outrage on Twitter, saying that such incidents are absolutely appalling and asserting, "This relentless assault on people and rights must end." Amal Ajlouni, one of the women subjected to the strip search, shared her traumatic experience with the Israeli rights group B'Tselem, stating, "I can't forget what happened, the search and the humiliation I went through in front of the female troops and the helplessness and shame I felt in front of my children. They are now afraid to sleep in their room at night and come to our bed. They don't sleep well and wet the bed, and when they wake up, they are scared to go to the bathroom." The assault has also garnered a strong condemnation from the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC, which called on international bodies to exert pressure on the fabricated regime of Israel to cease its daily violations of human rights in Palestine. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shatayeh denounced the egregious violation against the Ajlouni family, stating, violating the sanctity of our homes and harming our women is a provocative, disgraceful, and terrible act, which is practiced only by those who are stripped of morals and human values. Meanwhile, the Human Rights Committee of the Palestinian Parliament characterized the strip search as a demonstration of the extent of the ugliness and fascism of the occupation before the world, and urged the formation of an international investigation committee. They added, the Hamas resistance movement vowed revenge, deeming the incident a dangerous escalation that the Palestinian people and the resistance will not ignore. The violations committed by the fascist occupation will fall in the face of our steadfastness until the last soldier and settler are uprooted from our occupied land. Tariq Salami, spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, called on Palestinians in Al-Khalil and other West Bank cities to escalate their confrontations with the occupation and avenge the assault.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Last month, a group of senior military officers in Gabon took over power and removed Ali Bongo Ondimba, whose family ruled the Central African country for almost 56 years. Now, this military takeover came shortly after Gabonese Election Center confirmed that Bongo had won a third term as president with 64.27% of the vote. Now, Gabon's coup leaders rejected the results and named General Oligui Nguema as the country's transitional president. The people of oil-rich Gabon came into the streets to express support for the military takeover and celebrate the end of a dynasty that began with Bongo's father, Umar, in 1967. Now, Gabon, a former French colony, is the second biggest manganese producer in the world. This Central African country mined an estimated 4.6 million metric tons of manganese in 2022. Now, will the new government in Gabon ensure that the people of this country benefit from the country's wealth? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. In this week's episode, we are focusing on the recent military takeover in Gabon, the latest in a string of coups that have taken place in recent years in former French colonies. We are asking, is the coup in Gabon yet another blow to French interests in Africa? In the second part of our show, we are reviewing the latest developments in Niger as the country's transitional government continues to resist foreign interference and meddling, especially by France.
Unraveling Gabon's military takeover. The military officers who seized power in Gabon said the controversial re-election of Ali Bongo Ondimba did not fulfill the conditions of a transparent ballot. They also blame Bongo for irresponsible and unpredictable governance.
Now, for more on the recent military takeover in Gabon, we have contacted Donald Deya. He's the chief executive officer, Pan-African Lawyers Union, and chairperson, Pan-African Citizens Network. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
And thank you for having me, Mubarak.
Now, as we have seen there, the coup in Gabon came shortly after the country's election body declared that Bongo had won comfortably a third term. Did this come as a surprise to you?
No. The coup did not come as a surprise to me at all. There had been an election in Gabon. The election was not seen as free or fair, not by the people of Gabon, and not by the people from around Africa and around the world who are watching. So the regime and the administration forced itself back in despite the wishes of the people. So on that level, it's not surprising. But there's a larger question. there's a huge revolt and rejection of France and French domineering influence in Francophone West Africa and Francophone Central Africa. This has been going on in the people's mind for several years now, at least five. And a huge rejection of it in our countries, who are seen as agents of France and of the West. So that is partly what was playing on. So the Bongo family, the Ondimba family, are seen as stooges of the West.
The people of Gabon took to the streets in droves to celebrate the takeover. The support shown by masses following military takeovers in Africa is seen as a pointer to an increasing anti-France wave across Francophone Africa.
It is something we are seeing with every major coup, with every coup, that the military administration that comes in has no option but to reject French influence and to repudiate colonial era defense, security, and financial agreements with the French. And the people like this very much. So with every coup, you see the people celebrating. And we should not infantilize African people. It is not that they are naive or stupid, or that they do not know the risks that come with the military administration. They are actually being pragmatic and dealing with one problem at a time. And they are now prioritizing the removal of entrenched regimes and the client states for which they work, knowing full well that military administrations are no walk in the park either. But that is where a lot of Africa finds itself because of how we have mismanaged our democracy in many of our countries.
Now, the ties between Gabon and France were marked by close cooperation. Under Bongo's presidency, Gabon has been one of France's closest allies in Africa. Now, is the ouster of Bongo yet another blow to French interests in Africa?
There is a yes and a maybe to that question, Mubarak. On the one hand, yes, every time a regime that is closely aligned to France, that is seen as literally servants of the French, every time such a regime is toppled, indeed it is a blow to France and to the French administration. But there's something that's slightly different about the Gabon coup. I would argue, actually, that the Gabon and the Niger coup are on one side, and the Burkina, Guinea, and Mali coups are on the other side. The first three coups, Burkina, Guinea, Mali, are led by young soldiers who are outsiders from the administration. They're outsiders from the regime that has been in place. In both Niger and Gabon, it is senior military officers, actually the heads of the president of Gabon, who have undertaken the coup. So these are insiders who have been very close to the regime. So we are not sure yet whether it is a clear break from France and from the French administration, like the earlier three, or whether this is a stage-managed coup and will end up with a new administration that will still be very closely aligned to the French.
The French oil company Elf exploited a large part of Gabon's crude production. French companies also mined its iron, manganese, and timber for exports. Gabon also supplied uranium for France's nuclear weapons and power plants.
The poor masses in this Central African country are hopeful that the new leadership will stop the looting of the country's natural resources by French multinationals.
Vraiment, nous sommes fiers, nous sommes très heureux que l'armée a décidé de prôner pour la justice. Et nous rendons gloire à Dieu pour cela. Au Gabon, il y a un Dieu, et ce Dieu a répondu à nos prières.
Some analysts believe that the coups in Gabon, Niger, and Burkina Faso, and even Mali, signal trouble for France's economy, which heavily relies on Africa. Now, do you concur with this point of view?
Yes, it definitely signals trouble for the French economy, because the French economy has relied very heavily on its former colonies in Central Africa and West Africa, in a completely exploitative relationship that many people now refer to as France-Afrique. So yes, every single time one of the building blocks of Françafrique shakes, if not tumbles altogether, it is going to have an impact on the French economy.
Gabon's new military leader was sworn in as the head of state less than a week after ousting Bongo Ondimba. Speaking at his inauguration, General Nguema said the military had seized power without bloodshed and promised to return power to the people by organizing free, transparent, and credible elections. He presented the military as liberators of an oppressed society.
Tell. Une météorite dans la nuit noire.
Like a meteorite in the dark of night, our country's defense and security forces assumed their responsibilities.
C'est sans aucune violence.
It was without violence, without clashes, and without bloodshed that the Committee for the Transition and Restoration of Institutions, abbreviated CTRI,
CTRI,
changed the regime that had been confusing the power of the Republic's institutions for several years in flagrant disregard of democratic rules.
Au mépris flagrant des règles démocratiques.
The military takeover in Gabon is seen in the context of perhaps the recent military takeovers in neighboring Francophone countries, including Mali, Burkina Faso, and most recently, Niger. Now, should we expect more coups in Francophone Africa?
Yes, and the word for it is contagion. The region is influencing each other. As I said, the anti-French rejection among the ordinary people in a lot of Africa, certainly in Western and Central Africa, has been going on for over 5 years. Every single time Emmanuel Macron has come to the continent during his presidency, he has been met by protesting young students, protesting citizens, and so on. Social media has been on fire in Francophone Africa. There are now lines of solidarity between French-speaking Africa and Africans that speak other languages, English, Portuguese, Arabic, and so on. So there's been a groundswell of anti-French sentiment amongst the ordinary people. And that is why then, when there was a resort to military takeovers to dismantle established regimes, it has a lot of support of the people.
Well, there you have it. Military takeovers in Africa are becoming contagious. That's the view of our guest there, Donald Deah. He's the chief executive officer of Pan-African Lawyers Union, and I would like to thank him for his insight today. We're going to take a short break before the second part of our show on how Niger's new government continues in its struggle to reject France, a neo-colonial power intent on continuing its domination of this mineral-rich West African country. So stay with us.
Niger's struggle continues.
Niger's transitional government has accused former colonial power France of interference after the July 26 military takeover that gained popular support across the country. The authorities in Niamey have also announced the immediate expulsion of the French ambassador Sylvain Ité and announced the withdrawal of his diplomatic immunity.
France's President Emmanuel Macron has hailed Ité's refusal to leave Niger and arrogantly said he will forcefully stay in the country. Tensions are rising between France and Niger as Macron refuses to recognize the country's new leadership. The French military has also said that it is ready to respond if any renewed tensions in Niger target its military and diplomatic facilities.
The people of Niger are resolute in backing the country's government resistance against French neocolonialism. Protesters have particularly been angered by the arrogance shown by French President Emmanuel Macron.
How can he say without France there will be no Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger? Well, we don't need France to survive, but France is desperate for our resources. The only problem we have with the French is their selfish, arrogant leadership.
Well, for more on the situation in Niger, we have contacted Ibrahim Kane. He's a West African political analyst and founding member of the African Assembly for the Defense of Human Rights. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
Thank you for having me today.
Now, France is clearly unwanted in Niger. The immunity of the ambassador was revoked, and French troops have been asked to leave immediately. by the authorities in Paris in what is clearly a colonial and imperialistic posture, insists on forcefully remaining in this West African country. Now, what's the reason for these intransigences by Macron's government?
We should not also forget the fact that Niger is a strategic country for France, because Niger has one of the biggest quantity of uranium in the world. And that uranium is really very important for the energy in France. And Niger is also an important actor in stopping a lot of migrants of sub-Saharan Africa to go to Northern Africa in their effort to reach Europe. So at least for those two reasons, Niger is an important strategic place for France, and France will do everything to stay in Niger. And this difficult relationship with the new junta is related to that situation. The French don't want to leave that area.
The French military says that it is ready to respond if any renewed tensions in Niger target its military and diplomatic facilities in the conflict-hit West African country. There is concern that France might use its troops in Niger to engage in military adventurism in this country.
But at the same time, I think France is just warning the government of Niger that any action against its ambassador in Niger will have consequences. Military consequences, I don't think so, but France will do everything to protect the premises of the French embassy in Niger.
The new leader of Niger, General Abdourahmane Tiani, says the transitional government will launch a national dialogue to consult on a transition back to democracy, and that should last no longer than 3 years. The West African Regional Economic Bloc, ECOWAS, has rejected the three-year transitional period proposed by the new leadership in Niger. Neighboring Algeria has proposed a six-month transitional period led by a civilian to solve the crisis in neighboring Niger. Now, what's your take on these, and can we have a middle ground?
I really believe that the time frame from the transition will be very, very short, between 6 months and 9 months, and that transition will be used, I think, to really organize that dialogue that the government is proposing to discuss what next. I don't think that ECOWAS, just for it to be relevant in the region, will accept a long transition as it is happening in Mali or in Burkina, simply because ECOWAS needs to show its strength. ECOWAS needs to show that it's really keeping the principles, the norms, and the rules regarding unconstitutional change of government in the region very important.
The leaders of Mali and Burkina Faso have expressed solidarity with the transitional government in Niger as it continues its resistance against French neocolonialism. They have also rejected any military intervention in the country. The solidarity with the government in Niger is not only being demonstrated on an official level. Various commentators, journalists, unions, and civil society organizations have objected to the course which ECOWAS has taken in alliance with France against Niger.
The reality is that France is also trying to protect its own interests in the region, and ECOWAS' decision to really stop this military junta on its attempt to remain in power as coinciding those two interests. And I think in this regard, ECOWAS is also trying the last 2 weeks to really show that everything that he's doing is based on the normative framework of the community and has no link with the Westerners, despite the fact that they are also trying to get support, financial support, for the military action they want to undertake.
Niger's Prime Minister, Ali Mahamane Lamine Zein, says he is hopeful of a deal with the ECOWAS which has imposed sanctions on his country, apart from threatening military force to oust the new government. The people of Niger have meanwhile condemned sanctions imposed against the country by ECOWAS.
ECOWAS member states have continued to maintain their demand that the new government in Niger reinstates ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. Now, is this a realistic expectation at this point in time? And is a military option still viable?
I personally don't think that the return of Bazoum to power is realistic because we are now 6 weeks after the coup, and Bazoum back to power is a weak Bazoum. And I don't think that himself will accept to come back to power and be weakened. But at the same time, I think the other issues that ECOWAS is raising, for example, the return to constitutional order, is still valid and still important. And ECOWAS want that return to constitutional order as soon as possible. And I don't think that ECOWAS will even accept 1 year of presence of the military in Niger.
Now, both Washington and Paris are intent on using any means possible to maintain military and economic presence in Niger and the Sahel region in general to countercheck the growing influence of Russia and China. Now, are we going to see further escalation in the region as superpowers seek to maintain or establish a presence in this region?
If for the whole Sahel region, Russia has an interest. Interest just because the crisis in the Sahel region will also help Russia in its negotiation about the war in Ukraine. The more Russia creates a problem in the Sahel region, the more also the European conversation with Russia about Ukraine can also be about how to stop the crisis in the Sahel region. So at least strategically on that way, the Sahel region can be an interesting option for Russia at the moment. And if you see the way Russia is sending arms, is supporting military action in Mali and just recently in Burkina Faso, you will make the link with what is happening now in Ukraine.
There you have it. The superpower rivalry in the Sahel region is having geopolitical implications globally. Well, our time is over for today, but I'd like to thank our guest there, Ibrahim Kane, a West African political analyst, for his incisive analysis. Well, and that's all we had for this week at Africa Today.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, new data has shown that since the coronavirus pandemic, those living in poverty in England were 3.7 times more likely to be sent home than other pupils. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Increasing numbers of children from poor backgrounds are being suspended from schools in England since the coronavirus pandemic, according to analysis that estimates more than 3,000 pupils were sent home every day. The analysis was published as teachers, who took part in a separate survey, said verbal and physical abuse from pupils has increased significantly post-pandemic, with some having furniture thrown at them, being bitten, spat at, headbutted, punched and kicked. Meanwhile, the latest details from last year's SAT test published by the Department for Education showed the disadvantage gap in results is still significantly higher than pre-pandemic, with too many children from poor backgrounds failing to meet expected standards in primary schools. School suspensions where a child is removed temporarily because of misbehaviour has risen overall since the COVID pandemic, up 30% in 2021-2022, compared with 2018-2019. But they have gone up more sharply among disadvantaged children, up 75% versus 4% for those not in poverty. According to analysis by a new coalition called Who's Losing Learning, for the first time, more than half of all suspensions in 2021-2022 academic year, the latest available figures from the Department of Education, involved children from poor backgrounds, who were 3.7 times more likely to be sent home than other children in England. Both children with social workers and children with special needs were 4 times more likely to lose learning through being suspended, the coalition said. Repeat suspensions can be a warning sign of future permanent exclusion when children are told to leave their school forever. The new analysis found the increase in suspensions was highest in the East Midlands region, up 57%, followed by the northwest of England and the northeast of England, both on 34%, while Inner London saw a 7% increase. Black Caribbean children were 1.5 times more likely to be suspended than their white British peers. Dual heritage white and black Caribbean children were 1.7 times more likely, and Irish traveller and Roma, Gypsy and traveller populations were 2.4 times and 3.2 times respectively more likely than white British children. Kieran Gill, the chief executive of the Difference Educational Charity, one of the coalition members, said, "The COVID-19 pandemic may be over, but the pandemic of lost learning in England is actually growing. We should all be worried about the social injustice that the most marginalised children, who already have the biggest barriers to opportunity outside of school, are those most likely to be losing learning through absence, through suspension and through exclusion." A survey of 6,500 members of the NASUWT Teachers Union found almost 9 out of 10 said the number of pupils exhibiting physically violent and abusive behaviour has increased in the past year. Almost 3/4 of those surveyed cited poor socialisation skills following COVID restrictions as key driving factor behind the rise in poor pupil behaviour. More than a third, or 37%, reported experiencing violence or physical abuse from pupils in the previous 12 months, while 90% reported receiving verbal abuse, including being sworn at, threatened and targeted with racial or sexual insults. Patrick Roach, the General Secretary of NASUWT, said, "While concerns about pupil behaviour are not new, our research indicates an alarming increase in violent and defiant behaviour by some school pupils." Another study by the National Foundation for Educational Research, published on Wednesday, revealed the financial pressures on schools in England. It found a majority of primary schools are asking for more contributions from parents due to rising financial pressures. Almost half of primary schools and special schools and 2/5 of secondary schools had or were expecting an in-year deficit in 2022-2023, while just under half of mainstream schools expected an in-year deficit resulting in cuts to provision in 2023-2024. The Department of Education said it supports head teachers to take the action necessary to promote good behavior in schools. To support schools to do this, we have issued updated guidance on suspensions and permanent exclusions and are clear that extra support should be put in place where children are at risk of being permanently excluded and entering alternative provision. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. More than 340 children are suspended for violence against other pupils every school day in England, new figures from the Conservative Party has shown. Official data showed 65,390 pupils were temporarily excluded for violence against their classmates in 2022-2023, the party said. The figure is up by 2,720 on the previous year and amounts to 344 suspensions per school day. The Tories argued the figures demonstrate further evidence of the lack of discipline in schools. They have also highlighted large increases in suspensions in certain areas. In the London Borough of Southwark, the number rose of exclusions for violence. It rose from 166 to 348 last year, up 110%. Hartlepool saw the number rise 53%, while suspensions were up 50% in Middlesbrough. Exclusions were up more than 10% in London as a whole, with Inner London showing the biggest increase across England, up 20% to 3,430. Across England overall, the increase was 4.3% in 2022 and 2023. The government has defended the figures, saying teachers were using short, sharp shocks to control pupils in schools.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols helped to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
Went unconscious.
Cops used a chokehold that allegedly led to Eric Garner's death.
And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV.
Is his death not being called a homicide?
In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island.
passion.
You'll see these police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.